Hey people, Simon and Brian here, welcoming you to another episode of So Dejerker on Songwriting. Joining us for a chinwag today is one of the foremost British lyricists of the late 20th century and beyond. His long-standing songwriting partnership with Glenn Tilbrook in the band Squeeze is considered by many, us included, to be one of the greatest to spring forth from the British Isles, and ensures his name will be uttered in hushed tones by music fans and songwriting connoisseurs for generations to come. We are, of course, referring to Mr. Chris Difford.
It seems only apt that this episode should follow hot on the heels of our chat with Glenn. They're both hugely talented gentlemen in their own right, of course, but the music they made and continue to make together means a great deal to us, and it's a dream come true that we've now had the chance to speak with them both. Ergo, it felt right to us that these episodes should be sequential, and we hope you agree, dear listeners, because we love and respect you more than you'll ever know.
Indeed we do. Our interview with Chris is coming very shortly, but in the interests of full disclosure, we'd just like to tell you a little bit about the man first. He was born in 1954 in Greenwich, London. He began writing lyrics aged 12, and a few years later, with the encouragement of an English teacher, he took up the guitar and began setting his words to music. It was in 1973 that an 18-year-old Chris, looking to expand his musical horizons, placed an ad in a sweet shop window looking for a guitarist for his band, a band that didn't actually exist at that point, and only the 15-year-old Glenn Tilbrook answered it. This magical piece of happenstance set the ball rolling on a musical marriage that would change both of their lives forever.
That was very VH1 behind the music.
Thank you.
The two quickly fell into a division of labour that was really very straightforward. Chris would take care of the words, Glenn would set them to music, and it was this system that would see them eventually and justly regarded as national treasures. Our guest's storytelling abilities and keen, uniquely expressed lyrical observations of everyday British life, coupled with Tilbrook's prodigious melodic gifts, were a match made in songwriting heaven. By the close of the 1970s, their band Squeeze was already no stranger to the UK charts by dint of a raft of brilliant songs like Take Me, I'm Yours, Goodbye Girl, Up the Junction and Cool for Cats.
It was Mr. Difford, of course, who delivered the memorable, lugubrious, effortlessly cool vocal on the latter song. Chris's ability to weave a compelling narrative and paint vivid character portraits within a 3-minute pop song structure went from strength to strength during this early period of Squeeze, and wonderful lyrics abound on albums of that era, like 1981's East Side Story and 1982's Sweets from a Stranger, especially on songs like Vanity Fair, Tempted, Labelled with Love and The Elephant Ride, so many to choose from. Among Chris's growing list of admirers was Elvis Costello, who enlisted his assistance on the song Boy With a Problem from his 1982 opus Imperial Bedroom.
It's quite a feather in your cap when Elvis is asking you to write lyrics for him.
Oh, he's on to me all the time. Just voicemail after voicemail.
Squeeze took a well-earned break for a few years following Sweets from a Stranger, during which Difford and Tilbrook released the album, wait for it, Difford and Tilbrook, before embarking on Squeeze Phase 2 in 1985, a period which extended into the late 90s and generated a clutch of terrific singles and well-regarded albums, including Babylon and On, Frank, Play and Some Fantastic Place. The wonderful title track of the latter is considered by both Chris and Glenn to be their favourite song they've ever written. Following 1998's Domino, the band split seemingly for good, the same year they received their first Ivor Novello Award, and Chris became a solo artist, eventually releasing his acclaimed debut album, I Didn't Get Where I Am, in 2003, comprised of a clutch of songs co-written with Francis Dunnery. He also began to collaborate with a number of wide and varied artists, such as Elton John, Brian Ferry, Marty Pello, Lisa Stansfield, Lamont Dozier, and Chris Braid. I think it was around that time he was managing Brian Ferry too, and Marty Pello.
Wow, busy guy. Mm-hmm. A second warmly received solo set, complete with Tony Hancock-inspired album cover, followed in 2008, entitled The Last Temptation of Chris. Some masterful punning right there. That same year, Difford and Tilbrook received their second Ivor, this time for outstanding contribution to British music. A reformed Squeeze tour swiftly followed, and the pair have written, recorded and toured together on a reasonably regular basis since. Indeed, a brand new Squeeze album is tentatively scheduled for release this year in conjunction with an exciting new TV project.
In 2011, our guest released his third solo record, the excellent Kashmir If You Can, another fine pun there, which we've been spinning a lot at So Dejerker Towers recently. It's a lovely album, and if you ask us, some of the lyrics on there are among his finest ever, coupled with some really catchy tunes and subtle arrangements. You can hear a number of tracks from Kashmir on our Spotify playlist for this episode. Just head on over to sodajaker.com/podcast, select this episode, and there'll be a link underneath the episode player. We'll also post the link at facebook.com/sodajerker and at sodajerker on Twitter. And you can use each of these platforms to frolic with us, or if you so desire, romp. You can keep up with Mr. Difford's activities at his lovely official website, chrisdifford.com, and on his Twitter, at chrisdifford.
We almost forgot to mention Chris's hugely successful twice annual songwriting retreats.
Ah, yes, of course.
He's been very generously hosting those and offering fledgling writers the benefit of his wisdom for over 20 years now, I think.
Wow.
He's unique amongst our guests in that respect as well.
He is, yeah.
I'm very interested to hear what he has to say about those and a lot else besides.
As am I, old friend, as am I.
To which I say, here is our chat with the brilliant Chris Difford.
I find a way in my future to earn myself a place upon neon posters with stickers on my case. To be the one who I am, how could I survive without putting pen to paper?
Thank you so much for doing this.
No, I've been a fan of your interviews. In fact, I was exceedingly jealous because I saw them online and I just thought, God, I'd love to be involved in that.
Oh, right. Well, thank you. It's amazing what Twitter can do to bring us all together.
Yeah. Well, I do these interview evenings at a club in London, and I sit on a chair with a writer and we talk about songwriting, and then they play their songs. And somebody mentioned your site, so I went to have a look at it. And, of course, you've got all the amazing ones, and I've got all the crap ones.
Well, that is very humbling, thank you.
There you go.
So we spent a good portion of this week listening to your Kashmir If You Can album.
Ouch, I'm sorry about that.
No, we think it's a hell of a record. We absolutely love it.
Right. Okay, well, out of my three solo albums, that's my least favourite, but it is a good one.
Oh, that's surprising. We were going to say that it seems on that record that you're writing about a completely different kind of life than the one that you lived in the days of Squeeze.
Yeah, well, when I did my first solo album, it was with a guy called Francis Dunnery, who was in a band called It Bites. And I wholly recommend that you interview him because he's such an inspiration. He's an incredible guy. And he came to my house and said, in a kind of biblical fashion, I think you should make an album. And because I'd always been in the background behind Glenn, I'd never really had the confidence to do such a thing. And so Francis sort of took me by the hand, stood me in front of the microphone, and gave me the courage to do something that I'd never done.
Cowboys are my weakness. I act all weak and coy. My heart has a flutter. Words start to stutter. I'm crazy for the boy in his Cadillac by the diner steps. Cowboys are my weakness. They go straight to my head.
From Kashmir, the song Like I Did really leaps out to us. Although it's seemingly about your kids, you seem to reveal so much about yourself through it too.
Yeah, I think all three of my solo albums are very revealing. In fact, the second album, my kids listened to it and told me off for being so honest about our relationship. And in fact, they couldn't even listen to it. But, you know, songwriting is about honesty. And it's about, for me anyway, it's about revealing part of your soul that you don't normally let go of. And, you know, in Squeeze, it's always been very different. It's been me coming up with parts of my imagination and using the characters that live there to create songs. But when you do solo records, you can go deeper.
He's getting stoned like I did. He's playing bass like I did. He lays in bed like I did. How can I complain? He's telling lies like I did. He likes to sigh like I did. Swears at his mother. So how could I complain?
I think Passion Killer is probably one of the more honest songs from that.
Yeah, Passion Killer, working with Boo Hewardine, who I love working with, he's got a great sense of humour. He spotted that lyric and put that fantastic tune to it. you know, that very much is about somebody else, actually. It's not about me. When I wrote that, I was living on my own. I was a kind of gay bachelor kind of guy. And now I'm married and living with my wife's three children in a tiny house. And it's become a reality.
Well, we know what happens to people who live in very small houses.
Exactly, yeah.
We sneak around in the night and hope the kids don't hear us. When you live in a very small house, you end up with a very small penis. He's in his room with his cool mates. They play guitar and throw some shapes, tossing and turning under the sheets.
I guess there's a lot of songwriters out there, especially ones that we've spoken to, who claim that they write their best stuff when they're unhappy. Would you say that that applies to you, this notion of happy or unhappy?
I think songwriting is a therapy. You know, the writing desk, if you like, is like the psychiatrist's chair in some ways. And as I said, you know, when I'm writing for myself, I can go deeper and talk about how my feelings are and what upsets me or what makes me driven. And I have done that a little bit in Squeeze, but not as much when I'm doing it on my own. And I noticed that when Glenn writes, for instance, on his new solo album, there's a lot of deep stuff going on there lyrically for him, and musically too. So I do believe it's a form of therapy.
The truth, it's the toughest thing to explain. The truth, playing tricks with me again. When the truth has to be told, my blood runs hot and cold. The truth.
In addition to Glenn, you've worked with a number of very well-respected artists like Elton John, Elvis Costello, Brian Ferry. Is there someone who's really surprised you as a songwriter or taught you something about the process?
I think working with Elton was such an experience. He put the lyric on the piano and it was written in 5 minutes, 6 minutes. Then we got in his car and we went to a studio close to his house where a band were waiting. And he played it to them once. They recorded it. I was back in my house by tea time. I cried because I just never had an experience like that.
Look at you. Could I have been so foolish and so green? A fist and smile at every passing scene. Look at you. You're lost behind a web of woven time. When each emotion pinball in your mind. Look at me.
I think writing with Francis Dunnery was one of the most important times of my life because he really pushed me to do things that I'd never done. And writing with Glenn, on the other hand, is a completely different kind of chemistry, one that goes back 42 years and has a kind of unsaid personality all of its own.
We were the captain and to kneel. We were Lennon and McCartney.
Marty Pelo's another person that you've written for. I was wondering if you learnt anything specific from that collaboration.
Yeah, I learned how to juggle because I was managing him at the same time. So I would be writing lyrics for him, ordering Chinese meals and booking tours all in the same breath. So it was pretty hard work and he was relentless. When he first came to live with me at my house, after he came out of rehab, we had writers down every day of the week. And if he hadn't got one song down by lunchtime, he would be disappointed. So his addiction kind of changed from one part of his personality to another. So by the end of the day, every writer that we had down, we'd written three songs with.
Right, wow.
Moving back to Squeeze for a sec, there's a lot of colourful language in that material and detailed references to all manner of people and places. If you're writing a lyric for someone else to sing, will you ensure that the themes are a bit more universal or that it's not too colloquial?
Yeah, writing specifically for people is a challenge, but it's something that I enjoy doing. Last year, I got asked to write for Sarah Brightman, and I contacted her manager because she didn't want to take the phone call herself. Got off to a fantastic start. And I said, what is it that she's looking for? And the brief was spirituality and space travel. I knew a lot about spirituality, but space travel I hadn't a clue about. So it was a very interesting lyric that I had to write for her. She's going up in a spaceship in a couple of years' time. And so I wrote a song about that particular voyage that she's going on.
That must have been quite a challenge.
Well, it was and it wasn't, because I've always been interested in, you know, planes and jets and stuff like that. So, I mean, I was excited for her. Not something you'd catch me doing in a million years, but I was excited for her. So I took it from the view of a 9 or 10 year old boy who was going up in space, and then just planted her personality on top of it.
So what age did you actually start writing? Did you mainly start out with poetry or something like that?
Yeah, I started out, I lived on a council estate, and on the estate that three of us were into music, and out of the 20 or so kids that were there, and we had a band. I was about 16 at the time, and we just knock about in each other's houses making a bit of a racket. At school, I was bored stiff of you know, doing academic work. So I just used to write poetry. And one day a really good English teacher who was sitting in for another teacher, you know, a younger guy, spotted it and said, have you heard of Bob Dylan? And I said, no, I hadn't. And so he brought a record player in, he played a Bob Dylan album, and kind of the penny dropped that poetry could be songs, you know, that the two could marry up. So I just kept on writing with that inspiration that he'd given me. And I've got reams of it here, and it's just rubbish, really. But it was the building block to get to where I needed to be. And, you know, he was really influential. And also our art teacher was very forward-thinking, and she would let us bring records in. So I would bring records like King Crimson albums in that were very lyrically driven. And I was fascinated by Pete Sinfield, and I became a very big fan of his very quickly. And even sat outside his house waiting for him many years ago when he lived down in Somerset. And I remember waiting there in the rain for like about 6 hours, and he came out and got in his car and drove off, and that was it.
And were there any other particular songwriters that inspired you in your formative years, aside from, you know, Dylan? And
well, I always wanted to be in a band because I liked The Who and The Small Faces. They were like, you know, the energy of being in a gang always fascinated me, because I was in a gang as a kid. Always, there was always a lot of us knocking about, and so the idea of being in a band was just everything to me. So when I met Glenn, it was the obvious thing to form a band, and we formed a gang and went out on tour and caused havoc for a couple of years.
We noticed from one of your recent blogs that you're also a Prince fan.
Yeah, I went to see Prince last week a couple of times. I saw him in Manchester and I saw him in London, and I must say, I'm all funked out now. I don't need to see him for another 5 or 6 years. But, you know, he has that incredible aura around him where he obviously just rehearses constantly, mm-hmm. which is something I've never done. And every note is well crafted. And there are a lot of musicians that I know that are like that, but that's not really what I do. I'm more of a sort of see if it works kind of guy.
Yeah, I was at one of the Manchester gigs last week too. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, well, I worked with a band called the Stripes, and the Stripes were upstairs and Prince was downstairs. So I put the Stripes on stage, legged it downstairs to watch Prince, got all funked up, and then came back up to see the Stripes again.
So do you actually recall the earliest songs that you wrote? I think when we spoke to Glenn, he could actually distinctly remember the very first song that he wrote.
Yeah, I remember writing it. We were in the back of a van going to the Windsor Free Festival, and Glenn asked me for a lyric, and I had a lyric called Hotel Woman, and I gave it to him amongst like six or seven other lyrics, and didn't really question what I was doing. I just gave him the lyric, and he wrote a couple of tunes, and it quickly became apparent to me that my job as a songwriter, you know, writing music, was over, but there was something from then on that I was going to share with him.
It's kind of extraordinary to us that you could write, say, a complete lyric and not have to change it to fit the music that Glenn put to it.
Well, the lyric would always come first, and I'd never really normally have to change a word, and he'd just make it all twist around whatever he wrote. Later on in our career, there'd be a bit more sort of sandblasting of the lyrics to make them work. But generally speaking, the lyric is complete as can be. I've come across the desert to greet you with a smile. My camel looks so tired, it's hardly worth my while to tell you of my travels across the Golden East. I see your preparations, invite me first to
must have been quite a joy to pass him those words and then to receive back a tape with finished songs on.
It always is. And in fact, since Christmas, I've been working on a new batch of lyrics, and I gave them to him last week. And it's a kind of ritual that we go through. He asks me for lyrics. I say I haven't got any. And then I scurry around and come up with some ideas. And then about a month later, I give him a book folder with about 30 lyrics in it. And then he doesn't say anything. And then I wait for about 6 or 7 weeks. And then he says, I've read your lyrics. They're really great. And I'm working on them. And I got a message from his manager, Suzanne, yesterday saying that today is the day that he's opening the lyric book for the first time.
Great.
So we're on part two of that journey.
Very exciting. So in your sessions these days, then, when you sit down to write, how long will you write for?
Lyrically, I can, once I find that person inside, you know, the lyric guy, once I plug into him, he's there, and we just go off on one for a couple of weeks, and we just get bedded in with the ideas, and I sit here in front of my computer, and it's just an ongoing session. It just carries on until it's done, really.
And are there other places that are conducive to writing? I mean, I think when we spoke to Don Black, he said that a walk in the park sometimes produces ideas for him.
Yeah, I know that he writes on a snooker table, which I found fascinating when I spoke to him. I mean, they come everywhere, really. It's dependent on what's needed at the time.
Do you still write because you feel compelled to express yourself, or is it more to keep the muscle going because that's your job, essentially?
I don't keep, you know, Prince is a guy who keeps his muscle going literally every day of the week, in more ways than one. I'm not quite as refined as that, unfortunately. I've been writing a book, and that's been keeping me quite busy. And, yeah, I should write more, actually. You're absolutely right. I should write more. But it's just finding the time and the space. You know, it's a busy house, the one I live in, and it's a busy time. I'm working with a young band who are all over the place. You know, and Glenn and I are getting back in our stride. So there's so much going on that it's often difficult just to say I'm not doing anything other than writing lyrics.
Do you tend to have a notion of what it is you want to write about? Or is it more of a kind of a brain dump process?
It's a bit of both, really. On these lyrics just recently, I've been going back into the sort of earlier Squeeze time when I wrote in a kind of South London way. So I've taken myself back to that person who was sort of 20, 21 years old. And there's two reasons for that. One, because I really liked the lyrics that I wrote around that time, so I wanted to reaccess that kind of personality. And the other is because we're working on songs for a TV show that is based in that period with Danny Baker. And so I needed to put myself there. But also there's some lyrics in it about the passing of time, marriage, all the sorts of things that I've been going through.
Does a lyric tend to come quickly for you? And do you go back over things once the page is filled, like an editor?
I'm pretty quick. I kind of get the lyric done and then I'll come back to it a couple of days later. It's a bit like photography for me. I put the image into a process and I'll come back a few days later. And if it still looks like it's going to come up with something, then I'll carry on. If it feels like rubbish, then it just gets thrown in the bin.
And we wanted to ask about some Squeeze songs specifically, of course. Cool for Cats, for instance. What are your memories of actually putting that one together?
We had the backing track for that, which was on a cassette, and I was living in Greenwich in London. Put it constantly on the cassette machine, trying to find a way of writing a lyric for it. And I was getting stuck, couldn't think of anything. I had a bit of cheese on toast, a cup of tea. Benny Hill was on telly, so I watched a bit of Benny Hill. And it was Benny Hill that kind of inspired Cool for Cats, because the meter of his songs is very, very much like Cool for Cats. And so I came up with all these little vignettes of stories of TV shows, like Wagon Train and The Sweeney. I put them together. And the next day we went in the studio and Glenn said, "What have you got?" And I said, "Well, I'll read them to you." And they put a mic up and I read them to everybody in the band. And they said, "That's it." And that was it.
I have to say, I never thought I'd hear Benny Hill cited as an inspiration for a song.
Or for anything in particular.
The Sweeney's doing 90 because they've got nowhere to go. They get a gang of villains in a shed up at Heathrow. They're counting out the fivers when the handcuffs lock again. In and out of one swoop with the numbers on their names. It's funny how the missus always looks a bleeding sane. And meanwhile at the station there's a couple of likely lads who swear like as your father and they're very cool for cats, they're cool for cats.
We know from speaking to Glenn that on the music side, Tempted took a lot of hard work. But did the lyrics come more quickly?
Yeah, I know. He laboured over that. But then it's got lots of chords in it, so that's probably the reason. It's a genius song. Lyrically, it came very quickly. I wrote it literally on a fag packet in a taxi on the way to the airport. It was a box of senior service. I opened it up and started writing down what I saw. By the time I got to the airport, the song was done. And then I just put it in my back pocket. And then when I got back from the tour that we were on, I wrote it down, gave it to Glenn. And he spent a week writing it. And we recorded it first with Dave Edmonds. And Dave made it sound like ELO. It's a very different version. And it's really great, but it's not as great as the one that Elvis Costello came up with. I bought a toothbrush, some toothpaste, a flannel for my face, pajamas, a hairbrush, new shoes and a case. I said to my reflection, let's get out of this place.
Past the church and steeple, the laundry.
One song that you don't hear a lot about is King George Street.
Yeah.
We're actually big fans of that one. Do you recall how that one came together?
Again, that was a very easy lyric for me to write because King George Street was where I was born and I spent the first 12 years of my life. So it was very easy to visualise that story for me. It was written in a very complicated time in our relationship and Glenn put every chord under the sun into the song. And when he played it to me, I thought, wow, that's amazing, you know. And then when he gave me the chord sheet, I went, hold on a minute, how am I going to learn this, you know? when I look back at some of the songs that Glenn and I have written, things like King George Street, at the time I felt disappointed because I just simply couldn't play the songs. But now when I look back on it, I'm absolutely knocked out with what he did, you know. She left in the middle of the night with the kids, wrapped in a blanket with a packet of crisps, heading for her mother's on another state. The kids little dark, but the light in the rain. In the middle of the night, such a bench is
of course, another quintessential Squeeze song is Up the Junction.
Yeah.
Which is one that I actually find quite affecting emotionally. You know, once you've been through those big life moments, like having a child,
yeah,
you can really appreciate just how beautifully that song captures those sort of things.
Yeah, I mean, I love that song. I do it in my set now, but I do it like a Velvet Underground song. I do it very laid back and very dry, and I get the story across in a very slow way, dark way. Glenn is brilliant at bringing jolly to dark, but when I do songs in my set that we've written together, I just keep them as dark as they can possibly be. And it's a favourite of mine, that's for sure. It's a lyric that was very easy to write, and it was really inspired by watching Plays for Today that used to be on TV when I was a kid. And they were brilliant. They were sort of 30-minute plays written by people like Howard Pinter and Michael Frayn and people like that. And they were very inspiring to watch.
Were you ever tempted to try and build a chorus around the title of Up the Junction? It always seemed like quite a subtle move to leave that to the end.
No, not really. That was how it was written down on the lyric sheet. There's no chorus. And our manager, Miles Copeland, at the time said it would never be a hit because it didn't have a chorus. But our record company disagreed with him, and quite rightfully. This morning at 4:50, I took a rather nifty down to an incubator. But 30 minutes later, she gave birth to a daughter. Within a year of Walker, she looked just like a mother.
There's so many interesting turns of phrase in your lyrics throughout the Squeeze catalogue. You know, I'm thinking of stuff like perhaps she said I may be in Up the Junction, or at night the cricket's creepy and pulling muscles. Are they the kind of things that really please you as a writer when they flow out like that?
Well, they did then, yeah. I mean, they were, you know, I think when you're younger, you don't know what you're doing. You kind of just put pen to paper and you write. As you get older and you get more knowledge, it becomes a bit more of a trick. Like recently trying to write in that kind of genre from that kind of period has been an investigation, really, because you can't really go back in and tap that lyrical person because he doesn't exist anymore. He's grown up, he's had kids, he's, you know, he's had divorces, he's had bankruptcies, he's done this, that and the other. So you can only work within whatever you've got to work with. In those days, I didn't have any tools, and that kind of worked. They do it down on canvas hands, they do it at Waikiki. Blazing about the beach all day at night, the cricket's creepy. Squinting faces at the sky. A Harold Robbins paperback. Surfers drop their balls and drive. Behind the chalet, the holidays come.
specific tools that you use these days? Like, for example, would you document your ideas on a phone or a laptop or something like that?
No, I mean, I just sit here on my desk and write. I don't write any notes. In fact, you can probably see a bookcase that's full of folders with nothing in them. It looks great, though. It looks like I'm a really busy guy.
It's always good to present that image.
Yeah.
I recall from reading the book Song by Song that Hourglass was one that was written together in the same room. Kind of breaks your typical process.
Yeah, we wrote that together and in the same room. As an experience, I didn't really enjoy it that much. I thought it was a bit weird. If I could be so crude, it was like two guys trying to masturbate in the same room. It was very embarrassing. You know, it would have worked better if there was a red curtain in the middle. But yeah, I didn't. I mean, Glenn's talked about doing that again now, but I don't know. I find the process of writing very personal. I think you need space sometimes to be emotional. And when you're in the room with somebody, they bring all their baggage in with them. You've got all your baggage. Suddenly the room you can't move in because it's like full of baggage. So I'd rather just be in my own little space, really. Feel like I'm calling on a telephone.
And some of the early Squeeze tracks like Take Me, I'm Yours and Slap and Tickle make use of sort of electronic elements, and some of your recent stuff like Passion Killer kind of has that feel to it as well. Are you interested in that part of the record making process, or do you prefer to just concentrate on the words?
Glenn is a studio beaver. He loves being in there amongst the dials and different guitars and foot pedals, and you know, he's so happy, he's like a kid. His studio is just like wires are everywhere and there's keyboards from 1965. And I can't tell you how boring that is for me. I prefer to be somewhere else other than in a recording facility. I like recording live with a band because there's something really exciting about that. But when it comes to the minutiae of the rhythm or the guitar or the keyboard overdubs and stuff like that, I find it really tedious, although I know how important it is. So Glenn and I have not made an album together for about 16 years, so we're going to start work on one this year. I think I'm going to have to be a bit more tolerant to try and make that work.
And the last Squeeze song that we wanted to mention specifically is Some Fantastic Place.
Yeah.
Which I think is a perennial favourite for a lot of Squeeze fans.
Yeah.
It clearly comes from a very emotional place, but it's got a very positive focus musically and lyrically. Do you have any memories of writing that one?
Yeah. it was written about Maxine Barker, who was the girl that Glenn was going out with when I first met him. And she was the glue that brought us both together. She's the one that picked up the phone to call me when I put an ad in a sweet shop window. And she was the angel that looked over us in early parts of our career. And when she passed away 22 years ago, it was a no-brainer for me to sit down and write a lyric in memory of her. And I put pen to paper and it literally just flowed through me. It took about 2 minutes.
She gave to me her tenderness, her friendship and her love. I see her face from time to time there in the sky above. We grew up learning as we went what a voyage our lives could be. It took us through a wilderness into the calmest sea. Her smile could lift me from the pain I often found within. She's said some things I won't forget. She made a few bells ring. So simple her humility, her beauty found in grace. Today she lives another life in some fantastic place.
Before we finish, we wanted to ask about your songwriting retreats, which I think you run every year. What is it that happens at those events, and is it a useful thing for any budding songwriter to take part in?
Yeah, there are two this year. One in Glastonbury, just around the time of the festival, and that's in a beautiful house, and there'll be about 15 or 20 people there, I hope. And it's just really a hot house of people with ideas who are brave enough to work with people they've never met before. And today is actually one of the days when I'm working on that a little bit to try and find out who's actually going to come. The second workshop is in October, and that's with a foundation called the Arvon Foundation. And they're worth looking up. They're an incredible organization started by Ted Hughes some years ago. And they have three houses around the country, and they constantly have tuition taking place for not just songwriting, but for poetry, script writing, and all sorts of things. So those are the two places where I'm going to be nestled down this year. I've been doing it for about 25, 30 years, I think, and all the people that have come to the writing workshops have all remained in contact with each other. So in a way, it's been a lovely thing to create a community of writers, and they sort of share their experiences with each other even today, you know.
And is there part of the event where you give tips on how you approach writing songs, or is it mainly about facilitating their own process?
It's a bit of both. Some of the younger writers will ask me questions, and we'll sit and debate songwriting, and I'll give them my 10 penneth worth. But mostly it's about just putting them in a room, and, you know, you can't teach songwriting, I don't think. I tried it. I was a tutor at a university for a couple of years. Tom O'Dell was one of my students, in fact.
Right. Oh, right.
The people that ran the university gave me a great big book to follow. And at the beginning of the first period, I got the book and I took it outside, took all the students outside, and I set fire to it. I said, this is not going to teach you how to write songs, you know, but having a nice suit will.
Sounds like the Dead Poets Society.
Yeah, yeah. I'm doing it again now for an online university called EMU. We use Skype, you know, people can Skype me and ask me questions. It hasn't got off the ground yet, but it's in the process.
Is there anything else you're working on that you wanted to mention before we finish?
Glenn and I have got a tour called the At Odds Couple Tour. It starts in November, and the dates will be up online very soon, and it's a chance for Glenn and I to sit on stage and talk to each other about songwriting, and to tell the audience how much we hate each other, and and then play Squeeze songs and also play our own solo songs and debate them.
Wow, sounds fantastic.
Well, we'll certainly be there.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, thank you so much for...
Thank you for your time.
No, thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Great, thank you.
Cheers, Chris. Thanks a lot.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. Come on down, because the price is right. Come on down, I'll pay you back in time. Until I do, will you let me stay in love with you?
That was the very droll Chris Difford speaking to us from his home down south.
Yeah, lots of great insights into his process there that we hope you'll all take away and digest and use to your own ends.
It was certainly a thrill for us to get to speak to Chris. He is someone that we've admired for many years. So getting to complete our Squeeze doubleheader with Chris in addition to Glenn is just fantastic.
I never thought it would happen.
I see what you did there. So special thanks to Chris and Glenn for those two great episodes, and we will see you for the next one.
Bye-bye.
you'd like to listen to some of the songs referenced in our podcasts, visit our website at sodajerker.com, and on each episode page, you'll be able to find a link to Spotify where you can listen to a playlist of some of the biggest hits of the artists that we've been talking to.
Don't forget, if you'd like to get in touch, you can visit our website at sodajerker.com, or you can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/sodajerker. Alternatively, you can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/sodajerker. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Just search for Soda Jerker on Songwriting and remember to leave a comment. Until next time, I think we should say a prayer and drink to world peace.